To support the Historians Podcast, look for the GoFundMe link on our homepage, bobcudmore.com.
Hi, this is David Brooks of Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site, talking on the Historians Podcast with Bob Cudmore. And I'm looking forward to talking about a crossing situation, how the Erie Canal crossed through and then over the Schoharie Creek, along with some other really interesting tidbits of information, some strange things from Fort Hunter and along the Erie Canal.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. David Brooks, Education Director at Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site. The historic site has the word crossing in it. It seems to me this is a historic site that has to be explained. What do we mean by Schoharie Crossing?
Yeah, so a lot of times when I start explaining Schoharie Crossing, I have to kind of explain that we are not in Schoharie. We're not in the county of Schoharie. We're along the banks of the Schoharie Creek as it meets the Mohawk River here in Montgomery County in the towns of Glen and Florida and the hamlet of Fort Hunter. And so a lot of people think, crossing, what does that really mean? And the original canal had to cross through the waters of the creek. You have a creek that flows north into the Mohawk River, and the Erie Canal, going from Albany to Buffalo, is east to west, and that is counter to the flow of that body of water that is the Schoharie Creek. So the original crossing was through the water, and then what we're most known for is the remains of the Schoharie Creek aqueduct, which eventually would lead to having the Erie Canal cross over the water of the creek, making it a much easier crossing. That's the explanation that we start off with.
Well, and in fact, the remnant that exists there of the aqueduct makes more sense to me. How did you cross, or how did they cross the Schoharie Creek going through the water?
So the original crossing, this section of the Erie Canal opened in 1822. The entire Albany to Buffalo Canal opened in 1825. So the original crossing actually made use of a slack water dam. So in 1822, there was a dam constructed by Colonel John Littlejohn in the Schoharie Creek, just a little bit north of where the crossing would be, and that would be to raise the water level and also to calm the water as it's flowing to the north. And then there was a couple different methods. Most often it was a windlass ferry system where a barge would be attached to a rope that would be pulled from the other side and would bring them across. A lot of times those horses or mules would be put on another work scow or on the barge itself to be pulled. There's also a bridge that had gone across here, a pedestrian bridge, for a period of time that was also used for pulling the barges across. Either draft animals would walk on that. But for the most part, it was a windlass system, just as a rope ferry to cross through that water. And on occasion, the water of the Schoharie was moving so rapidly that that section of the canal would actually have to close. So this crossing would have to stop. And a lot of times to explain that to folks, I mentioned if you were on the New York State Thruway and you're driving across the state and there's a section of that that is because of an accident or deemed impassable, that you'd have to stop and wait, or you'd have to back up in some way and get off at another exit. But on the canal, there weren't really exits. You just had locks to go through.
I think it's interesting that with this crossing the canal itself, you had to get the animals across that were mostly the motive power that pulled the boats, the barges. And so you put them on the boat and sent them across, right?
Yeah, yeah. And for the first couple of seasons, because the Canal Commission Fund, those documents are still housed in the New York State Archives, so you can look at those. And the first couple of seasons, while they're working out the details of how they're going to be operating a rope ferry or draft animals going on or off these barges, there were some work scows or some other rope ferries that were being used that would also transport the animals. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do like to talk about the bridge that went across here, but that wasn't suitable for the heavy use of, you know, hundreds of barges coming through and their draft animals walking across it.
This worked, but not that well, and that's why another method was sought to cross the Schoharie.
Again, it would work really well unless you had an inflow of water, rains from a couple days before. The Schoharie Creek would really begin to, you know, it's near the end of a 90-mile stretch of watershed, and so that water would be moving too fast, and they'd have to close it down, causes that backlog of traffic, which, you know, the recently down in the Suez kind of shows what that means when you have a backlog of barges
and
how much longer that would take. So making that relevant today, you know, that could very well happen right here with dozens and dozens of barges being held up for days at a time. When they first had built the original canal and it opened in its entirety in 1825, they kind of knew the Schoharie was a problem, that this was going to be an issue, but they just didn't have the ability at that point in time to create another method of crossing. So during the enlargement phase happens from the 1830s to 1860s. And in several phases, they increase the width and the depth of the canal. Instead of a single chamber lock, they create a double chamber lock. And most importantly, particularly in this area, they create the Schoharie Creek Aqueduct. So they build the 624-foot, 14-arch structure with a wooden trough that would actually carry the canal over the creek. And you didn't have to worry what the Schoharie Creek was doing at that point in time. The only concern would be ice flow in the spring. The canal wasn't operating at that point yet. So it really mitigated so many of the problems with transportation through this section.
Was this the major construction project, building this sort of water bridge?
Yeah, it was actually noted after its completion by the Public Works Department that it was almost the single most important improvement of that era because of its transportation over the creek.
Was the Schoharie Creek the biggest obstacle the canal faced of that kind? I mean, because there are a whole bunch of creeks and so on that intersect the canal or the old canal.
Right. So here in this section, which would have been Section 3 or the eastern section, the Schoharie proved to be one of the bigger impediments. Obviously, as you go toward Waterford and Cohoes area, you have the Cohoes Falls. That was a real difficult task to create a series of locks. The original canal, it took something like 20 locks to get around the falls. The enlarged, it was the 16s. And then if you go out further west, the Montezuma Swamp was quite difficult to navigate through in construction. And then Lockport area and the deep cut, there was essentially 7 miles of rock that they had to blast and dig through in order to get to toward Buffalo through the escarpment.
So the Schoharie Creek was just one of several bodies of water that the canal had to kind of fight against.
Yeah, in the original canal, there were several, 8 to a dozen or so slack water crossings on smaller creeks that would go through. And really during that enlargement, it was that process of creating smaller aqueducts or rerouting the portion of the canal to make that an easier proposition of transportation.
How long was the aqueduct in use?
It went into use actually, well, the construction of it was 1839 to 1841. It took a couple of years for everything else to line up, and it didn't go into operation until 1845, and that operated right up until 1916. In this section, that is when the Mohawk River was going through its canalization. The wooden trough was removed from the aqueduct to be used in construction and Rotterdam Junction, actually, at Lock 9, that aqueduct was no longer in use. This modern canal, if we think about it today, this barge canal system in New York, and particularly in the eastern section of the Mohawk River, opened in its entirety in 1918. But the aqueduct, again, it was 1916 that operated until.
We're talking with David Brooks, who's education director at Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site. When people go to the historic site, what do they see of the old aqueduct? It's kind of a ruin, is it not?
Yeah, I like to say remnants. It sounds a little less depressing.
Okay.
But it also, to me, it kind of invokes Thomas Cole's paintings, The Rise and Fall of Empire. So nature is kind of reclaiming parts of it. We kind of combat the brush and the shrubbery around it to make sure that people still have access or view to it. But there are 6 arches that remain from the 14 that were built. I'm not a really good math student, but that's somewhere about 40-41% that still stands. You can view it from either bank of the Schoharie Creek. We have parts of the site on the west bank as well as the east. And we're actually pretty enthusiastic. There's a stabilization project that's going to be happening hopefully very soon. Montgomery County had accessed some grant funding. New York State Historic Sites Bureau is putting in additional funding. And the stabilization project should be moving forward in the very near future, just to at least stabilize those 6 arches that remain and the piers that exist there as well. And then hopefully, you know, in future years, if we can make sure that structure is still there for the public, either reconnect it in some way. To rebuild it in the way that it was originally constructed would be not only out of majority of anybody's budget, but also would still lead to some of the problems. One of the reasons why not all of the aqueduct still exists is because of the ice jamming. When it wasn't needed for the canal anymore, and there created ice jams, it caused flooding. So arches were intentionally removed to remove that that flood risk that the ice would cause.
In addition to the crossing itself at the State Historic Site, Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site, you also cover other aspects of canal history. What are some of the other things on the grounds there?
Original Erie Canal section, we have the area in which the original crossing was in Clinton's Ditch. We have versions of the enlargement. We're right adjacent to today's modern canal. We have a really interesting pre-canal history as a location for a version of Fort Hunter, as well as the Mohawk Lower Castle. The Haudenosaunee people having settled in this area, obviously, for generations before a European settlement. But we do have some of those artifacts from the fort, the outline of that area as well. So that's all kind of included because the transportation way of the Schoharie and the Mohawk and that confluence, the joining of those bodies of water, and it's also the joining of so many cultures. And I think that here in Montgomery County in particular, you have the Mohawk River that really highly illustrates the movement of not just water, but of people and their ideas. And so we try to talk about those aspects of the canal and also our pre-canal history and how that's an emergence of peoples coming together for trade or whether it's engineering projects or commerce, you know, all of those things, you know, industrialization. We talk here about the stores that existed, the canal stores. There was the creamery and other factories. Brew making was really widespread in the Mohawk Valley for decades. We try to get into all of that as well and how that all really does tie into the canal going through the communities along this section of New York, but across all of New York and how that opened up into the interior of the continent.
Also, you have given talks on some of the strange little tidbits of history you wrote along the canal in the Fort Hunter area, which is where you are.
In doing research for anything, particularly accessing old newspapers, you always come across just these little blurbs of information. And I've talked with other historians, and what you try to do with that is generate something. If you don't have time to research it now, maybe you can later. I know Peter Betts, who's a frequent guest, writes some really great articles. There's other folks like Samantha Hall-Saladino up in Fulton County that'll have programs where they're just too juicy, they're too good, they're too interesting. And even if you don't have the ability at that time to research them further, or maybe you hit a dead end, like you want to share those. And a lot of them have to do with how that kind of connects to, you know, other parts of our history, but it's also a way to be relatable to human beings of 100 or 200 years ago. Human beings are very similar now. The technology is different than, you know, a couple hundred years ago. So a lot of these, you know, there's murder and mayhem, there's some arson, just accidents that you come across. And I kind of feel like when I hit a certain story or tidbit, even if I can't find more information, it's a story that I feel needs to be told. So I'll incorporate it into some of these programs, like the Strange History from Along the Canal program.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us some examples?
So there's one of my favorites is actually it incorporates some of our history here, a little bit of railroad history, and it's about Picky. Picky Fuller was a guy that had befriended the Brown brothers who operated the canal store at Lock 30, part of the enlarged canal system. Apparently there was a falling out, and so the Brown brothers used an old factory building up near the West Shore Railroad freight line. He had that falling out with him, and at some point that storehouse was broken into, and several barrels and bags of flour were thrown into the old canal, so the Clinton's Ditch Canal that became a feeder. He had apparently gone through and dumped a bunch of their flour into that canal prism. And then took off to Johnstown. So he was arrested up in Johnstown, and the newspaper reported something to the effect of how he was so covered in flour as to look that he had rolled around in it. So, you know, people have arguments today, so maybe they can kind of relate to that revenge aspect. And I often make the Scooby-Doo reference. He probably looked like a villain from Scooby-Doo covered in flour.
No doubt. Well, and any others that you can tell us about?
Yeah. So I try to incorporate, like I said, a little bit of these fun stories. To me, that's amusing because, you know, he's listed off. his nickname's Picky, but there's also some other tragic stories about a guy like J. Ferdinand Brown, who apparently was with this couple of gentlemen transporting lumber along actually the towpath. They were in a wagon, so it wasn't a canal barge. But they were on the towpath leading up to the aqueduct when he had gotten off to lighten the load of the wagon for the horse in its approach. And apparently underneath some inebriated state of some kind, as the newspaper says, he had fallen into the canal itself and drowned.
Oh, dear.
So you can kind of talk about the tragedy and you know, the lightheartedness of one story can also highlight the tragedy in which this gentleman had lost his life right at Lock 30, which is part of our site, and that the locals had come out to help retrieve his body as well. So there's, like I said, there's a lot of these. I guess it really is kind of these tragic stories that you really have to highlight with some level of humor if you can as a way to manage.
What did they do with the canal back when it was a canal? It was a very placid body of water, wasn't it, or was it?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah, there was a very minor amount of flow to it, but because you have those locks in place on the original and the enlarged, in particular, that the sections between locks, you'd have small wakes created by the barges, but there was a speed limit, a 4-mile-an-hour speed limit. One of the reasons why, even after steam technology and gas power kind of comes out in the later 1800s, that you still have draft animals pulling barges, is to maintain the walls of the canal. You don't have the same erosion factor from draft animals pulling barges. So there's a lot of folks, you know, there's everything from, there's the canals being used as a waste receptacle throughout communities. There's, you know, these wonderful idyllic images of little boys fishing along the canal. I'd hate to think that they're eating stuff from the canal water. But most often, people utilize the canal, obviously, as transportation. They would use the berm side or the towpath side. It was essentially not just a state canal, but there's a state road from Albany to Buffalo. On both sides of that was the ability to kind of walk, or it might be illegal to drive your wagon or carriage down the towpath because you're not towing an animal, but it was done. It was done frequently. And in the Fort Hunter area, there's examples of that come out in the newspapers where there's issues. There's a county representative and his wife that wound up getting into an accident when their horse takes a misstep, and it's this nice, written up in newspapers today don't have the same finesse to their storytelling, I guess. You know, where he's pushing his wife off the wagon and jumping off himself before the horse plunges into the canal, bringing everything with it. People utilized it for that, a means of conveyance and other industry. Early on, factories being set up along the canal for, you know, the ease of transportation, but also a lot of wastewater. Waste weirs were created, so if you have an overflow of water in a section, that could generate a water wheel to create power for your mill or your factory. And then just the sheer ingenuity and entrepreneurialism of a canal store. You establish a small lock stand somewhere near a lock or a basin, one of those pull-off and service areas near a dry dock maybe, and you'd be able to sell your dry goods and other wares to people. Maybe you'd had boarding rooms for passengers. They wanted to overnight someplace. Probably really good business, not just operating the saloon, but also some of the shadier aspects of the canal life, you know, going around the back of buildings, and men could easily lose their wallets or their lives in some sections.
Did people swim in the canal?
Yeah, and there are some, in the earlier eras of photography, there's some images of boys and other adults kind of playing within the water. They're just swimming. You start getting a little bit later on, the 1880s and 1890s, with some excursion boats, because it was even a recreational way then, or, you know, through this area. I think there were some excursion boats like the Kitty West and the Nokomis that come from the Schenectady area.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They'd come out past the aqueduct to Orrsville Shrine. And those are like light steamers, so they were able to kind of ply the waters. And there's, you know, great images of those out there of what it almost looks like, effectively, like people are trying to water ski behind these boats, or they're hanging onto the boat from. They're in the water and they're holding on to the outside of it.
That's right. I'd heard of the Kitty West, and as you say, that was steam powered. It wasn't pulled by horses.
Near the tail end of the operation of that enlargement, you start getting, and they're mostly those small packet or excursion boats that's not used for transportation of really heavy, you know, 20, 40-ton barges.
We're talking with David Brooks, Education Director at Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site. One other story that you tell has to do with the kind of the father of the canal, DeWitt Clinton. The title is DeWitt's Duel, Political Rivalry at 10 Paces. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was kind of spurred on by this, again, doing other research, coming across an article, and then kind of connected. There's this big push toward this guy everybody's heard about, this Hamilton, I guess. There's a musical about Hamilton and his famous duel with Aaron Burr. But I'd come across an article a few years ago talking about DeWitt Clinton and his duel on the plains of Weehawken. So I started doing some research on that, and there is a Burr connection. DeWitt Clinton, before being sort of the father of the canal, you know, he's heavily engaged in politics in New York State. His uncle had been governor. DeWitt Clinton becomes a secretary to him. He's, you know, vying for political offices, becomes state senator. Becomes the mayor of New York City before becoming the governor and being known for the canal. But in the early 1800s, a lot of that political intrigue that's happening, particularly around New York and the New York-New Jersey area of politics that really, you know, spurs on the duel that would be Hamilton and Burr that is really well known in American history. There's a lot, you know, vicious name-calling, political backstabbing, and politics back then wasn't just party. It was party and personality. Even within, like, the Federalist Party, the Democrat Party, you had factions within that. So there's the Clinton faction that emerges, and that's very anti-Burrite for the Burr faction of this political party. And so there's a lot of back and forth and exchanges, and one of Burr's friends is going into this back and forth with DeWitt Clinton. DeWitt Clinton calls him a scoundrel in the kind of a public way. It wasn't like it was out there in the newspapers, but, you know, to just the right people. So the gentleman by the last name of Swartout says that his honor has, you know, been affected by this and calls for an apology. DeWitt refuses to apologize, and so they schedule a date and time to meet in New Jersey, because as the Hamilton play says, everything's legal in New Jersey. And they meet there and exchange gunfire.
They survived, or what did they do?
You want the spoiler alert?
go ahead.
Again, DeWitt Clinton, you know, they meet up, and Swartout has this document for DeWitt to sign so they don't have to fight, and if you apologize, we don't have to do this. Clinton absolutely refuses. The first round, they exchange, they shoot at each other and miss. Neither one of them are satisfied. DeWitt won't apologize. Swartout won't stand down. They exchange gunfire a couple more times. Swartout was actually struck in the leg twice and still refuses to give up the ground and says that DeWitt Clinton has to apologize, that he's there for his honor. So after the fifth exchange of gunfire, DeWitt Clinton says he's not going to continue the duel, and he walks away. And is actually maligned in newspapers and other publications as being a coward for having left the dueling field after exchanging gunfire five times with Swartout and actually injuring him twice.
But he kind of overcame it, or the bad press, if you will?
Yeah. So the bad press kind of fades out after a while. There is a reconciliation that happens just a few short years later between the Burrites and the Clinton faction. They actually have this really big event down in New York City, kind of showing that they're unified at a restaurant, and it kind of plays out fairly calm and easy for that. Clinton goes on as mayor, governor of New York. He isn't maligned for very long on the cowardness of leaving the dueling fields.
We're talking with David Brooks, Education Director, Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site in Fort Hunter. By the time that we actually put this on the internet, it'll be toward the end of October, and we're getting into the late fall season. Schoharie Crossing is... are you open throughout the year, or when are you open there?
Yeah, so the visitor center will be closed by the end of October. We'll open up for some appointments or groups. So if there's a group that wants to come in and experience the Pathway to Empire exhibit, you can do so by getting a hold of us, and we can schedule that. We'll reopen the visitor center in May of next year. The grounds of the site, though, are open. It is a state historic site with over 200 acres, miles to explore, and you can come do that any day of the year between sunrise and sunset.
Could you, there's the Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site, focusing on the Erie Canal and other history, but is there another history site that you'd recommend in connection with the canal somewhere else in the state of New York?
Yeah, so there's several great locations. If you're in the Waterford and Cohoes area, there's a visitor center. You can always see the flight and the side cut. So the flight of locks to get around part of Cohoes Falls that is in operation today, and the small side cut that goes up to the Champlain Canal is also a great location. Parts of Schenectady have, like Vischer's Ferry is a great nature preserve. They also have remnants of the canal. If you're headed out further west, St. Johnsville has Lock 33. That's a great enlarged era lock that you can check out. There's a small park there. So you keep on going throughout towards Syracuse. The Erie Canal Museum is by far, should be on the to-do list of anybody that's going to be in the Syracuse area, especially if you're interested in the canal. Even if you're not, it's right near Clinton Square. It's where the Erie Canal and the Oswego Canal met. It's an old Waylock building. It's got a great preservation story that goes behind that and wonderful programs and exhibits inside there. They're open year-round. Further out west, you know, if you're coming back from the Buffalo area from some excursions out there, during the open season, the nice weather, there is the Port Byron Center. The Canal Society of New York operates that. It's got great exhibits and wonderful canal history there. Great model of a canal section and a lock from the enlarged Erie Canal.
Mm. Do all you guys get together for a canal, I don't know what, symposium? You Zoom each other probably and talk
so
canals.
In the age of COVID, we've done a lot of that, which has been nice. You know, other canals in other parts of the country or other parts of the world can have these programs and exchanges with each other. The World Canals Conference just happened at the beginning of September down in Hagerstown, Maryland. There is the New York State Canal Conference. It's happening at the end of September, and it's actually being hosted out of the Rivers Casino there in Schenectady. And so, yeah, there's a lot of canalers, canal heads. You know, the American Canal Society is a part of that, the International Waterways Society, New York State Canal Society. If there's an interest in canals, there's a great way just Googling up canal societies to find out where that aligns to interests and when there's meetings and programs. Once that canal water gets in your blood, it's kind of hard to shake it.
How about that? And how did you end up working there?
Almost by sheer luck. I had put in an application to state parks, and there happened to be an open spot here. I have a little bit more of a, my educational background follows a little bit more earlier American history, and so I kind of took up the task of learning more about the canal, and I've come to the realization, I've been doing this for almost a decade now, and I could probably do this the rest of my life and still not feel like I knew everything about the canal. There's so many avenues to go and so many directions, which I guess makes it exciting because there's something new that you can discover almost any time you dive into the research.
Well, David Brooks, I thank you very much for joining us and giving us some Erie Canal history.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Brooks is Education Director at Schoharie Crossing State Historic Site in Fort Hunter, New York. You can support the Historians podcast by clicking on our GoFundMe link, which you find on our homepage, bobcudmore.com. You've been listening to the Historians podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.